Who or what landed in the forest outside an airbase in England in December 1980? How did subsequent events change the lives of the officers and enlisted personnel who came into contact with it? Why did UFOs seem so interested in what was stored at the base?
Hey, and welcome to the 128th broadcast of Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Benino, and also our three-hour combined special with Caps Paranormal. I'm Benino, and opening the show was my co-host and partner in the paranormal, my dad.
And here are our gracious co-hosts from Caps, Dave and Tom Jones. Say hello, guys.
Hey, hello.
Thanks for letting us come on here, man.
Sure. This is Dave. Thank you so much, Paul. We appreciate getting the opportunity to be on with you. And Tom, I feel automatically elevated because we're on a much better show than we do.
I do. You know, I'm getting, you know, it's great. It's top notch.
Yeah. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you for your graciousness, guys.
Okay, well, our job, that is the four of us hosts here, will be pretty much to direct traffic among our six panelists this evening and during our last hour among callers. Now, Dave and Tom, you fellows are monitoring the chat room at parax.com, I understand, and can you tell us how people can use that to send in questions?
Yeah, they can go to para-x.com, para-x.com, click on live chat. That'll throw you into the great big chat room at Parax. If you've got a question, you can private chat me, and I'll get the question.
Great.
To them.
Okay. And Ben and I have some advance emails from listeners as well, so we have plenty to ask our guests tonight. So we'll work those questions in as the panel discussion allows. December 2010 will mark the 30th anniversary of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incidents, often referred to as Britain's Roswell. For our combined show tonight, we've assembled a panel of four eyewitnesses and two eminent UFO experts, some of whom have never been on the air together before. Now, we're honored to have the four witnesses whom we believe are true American heroes, and we thank them for their service and especially for what they went through in regard to this case. We're honored to have Colonel Charles Hall, U.S. Air Force retired, former Air Force personnel John Burroughs, we hope. John is supposed to call in from an airport. He's between flights, just in case we don't have him. We do have a pre-recorded interview with him. So also Steve LaPlume and Larry Warren. We also have Bill Burns, publisher of UFO Magazine and star of the History Channel's UFO Hunters, along with Peter Robbins, co-author with Larry Warren of the book Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Bentwaters Woodbridge UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. Now, if you have access to a computer, check the Talking Points page at BehindTheParanormal.com for some illustrations and some documents and a background relative to the Rendlesham case and for a link to buy the book.
My dad and I will moderate the first hour of the show, and Dave and Tom will take over the last 2 hours. And please hold all calls until our last hour.
Unless told otherwise, we're kind of winging this tonight. There might be time for calls at some point.
Yeah,
Now, unfortunately, UFO expert Nick Pope, a former chair, chief of the UFO desk at the British Ministry of Defense, was unable to join us tonight live because he's on a plane, too. But he did provide us with a basic introduction to the case. Will, if you would roll that tape, please. Okay, we're very glad to welcome Nick Pope, who unfortunately was not able to join us live. But Nick is going to give us a bit about himself and also a background to get us started off in our discussion of the Rendlesham Forest and Bentwaters Woodbridge case of 1980. So take it away, Nick.
Sure. Well, my background is that I worked for the British government for 21 years. I was at the Ministry of Defense, and for much of the early 90s, I was given the job of running the small UFO project, which really mirrored the work that Project Blue Book did for the United States Air Force for many years. Now, the bread and butter of that job was investigating newly reported sightings, and we used to get about 200 or 300 each year. But I was able to undertake some longer-term research projects, and one of the things that I did was undertake a cold case review of the Rendlesham Forest incident, because I felt that it was easily, from my reading of the archive of files, it was easily the most compelling UFO incident that had been reported, certainly to the British government.
So can you tell us what happened? I understand there were activities over three nights, and can you begin with day number one, night number one, and what occurred?
Yes, let me try to give, I suppose, an executive summary of these events. It was, as you say, an incident that took place over, some say two, others say three nights. There's some confusion about this, and not all the participants agree on all the facts. And in a sense, that's a good thing. If you ever come across a story where everyone's in complete agreement, it sounds as if there's collusion. In a real incident, particularly if it's something above and beyond most people's training or experience, you would expect to find these sorts of discrepancies. So that, it's not a problem. Effectively, things started in the early hours of the 26th of December 1980, and some people reported seeing strange lights in Rendlesham Forest. Now, Rendlesham Forest lies between the twin bases of Bentwaters and Woodbridge. These are United States Air Force bases in the county of Suffolk in the United Kingdom. Although they're twin bases, they're actually under unified command, so they're treated to all intents and purposes as if they were a single establishment. Now, thinking that one of the aircraft based there, possibly an A-10, had crashed short of the runway, they sought and obtained permission to go out into the forest and investigate, see if a formal search and rescue operation needed to be instigated. It was very quickly apparent to them that what they were dealing with was not a downed aircraft, and three individuals went out into the forest, John Burroughs, Jim Peniston, and Ed Kavanasak. Now, Kavanasak was told to stay a little bit further back because one of the interesting things about this was that the radio communications were somewhat patchy. So to act as a relay, Kavanasak was told to remain further back. So Jim Peniston and John Burroughs approached the object at somewhat closer range, and well, of course, John will give his own account of this. Jim Peniston's account has been placed on the record, but effectively, it was reasonably clear that we were talking about a metallic craft of some sort. Now, obviously, this is where theories are doing the rounds. Some people say it was an extraterrestrial spacecraft. Some people say that it was something from another dimension, another time even. Others say, well, maybe this was some sort of psychological operation to test the reaction of the troops, or that it was some sort of prototype aircraft or drone. So there are many, many different theories, but it was certainly quite an extraordinary encounter.
Hmm. It's funny. Well, John Burroughs hopefully is on our panel live, but we have recorded an interview with him in which he describes much of what you say, expressing the opinion that it was a future experience, a futuristic craft of some sort, but human. Anyway, what about the second night?
Well, on the second night, the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, was at a social function, and all of a sudden, the doors burst open. One of the officers came up to him, saluted, said to him, "Sir, it's back." And Holt looked a little bit confused for a moment, and he said, "What are you talking about? What's back?" And the man said, "The UFO, sir. The UFO has come back." So now Holt had become aware of the experiences that Burroughs and Peniston and Kavanasak had had on the previous night, and indeed he had taken witness statements from those three individuals and I think two other personnel who were more peripherally involved in that, and from memory that's Fred Baran and Ed Chandler, who were also involved in the initial sighting and call-out that led to Burroughs, Peniston and Kavanasak being deployed into the forest. Now, Holt said, and he's gone on the record many times as saying, he thought all this UFO business was nonsense, and he said, "I went out there into the forest with a small team of about half a dozen people to try, as he put it, to debunk this UFO nonsense." But he wasn't able to debunk it. He actually ended up becoming a part of it, and indeed he and the men with him encountered the UFO again. This time, unlike the first night, it was not landed in a clearing in the forest, but it was above them, and indeed at one point it fired a narrow beam of light down at the ground, close to their position. At one point it was again approaching Holt and his men, and at the end of the evening it was seen over the base at Woodbridge, firing light beams down into one of the particularly sensitive areas in that military establishment. So this was a very interesting incident, because of course as the deputy base commander, Colonel Holt effectively became one of the most senior military officers ever to have seen and reported a UFO whilst on duty. And of course it's interesting, one of the pieces of evidence is that Holt took out with him a number of things. He took mobile light generators called lightalls to try and illuminate the forest and see what that might reveal. Those started cutting out, a little bit like the radios did on the previous night. But what he took was a handheld miniature tape cassette recorder, and he recorded about 17 minutes on and off of his observations. And again, that's in the public domain, and it's quite a compelling account, and one can hear, I think, the tension in Holt's voice and in the voices of some of the other people out there in the forest as they encountered this thing.
Well, we're very fortunate to have Colonel Holt on our panel. Okay, we're going to stop it there because we have to take a break, folks, and we'll be right back on Behind the Paranormal and CAPS Paranormal, our combined shows. Sounds like Barnum and Bailey, doesn't it? With our panel. So stay with us.
And we're back. So let's get our panel going, and we'll try to limit each introduction to about 5 minutes. So, Colonel Holt, let's start with you. Would you tell us a bit about yourself and what happened to you in Rendlesham Forest?
Well, it was a rather startling thing, I guess, is the best way to put it. I was a non-believer. I was at the annual Christmas party, which was a family affair, when the police, on-duty police lieutenant came in and said, "It's back." I'd heard something 2 days earlier as far as it was an incident, but, you know, I thought there was a rational or logical explanation. And, well, I guess I was in shock whenever he came back and said, "It's here." So I went home and changed clothes and had the disaster preparedness officer get a APN-27, which is a Geiger counter, and his camera, and five of us went out into the forest. We got into the forest. It was a great assembly, I guess is the best way to put it, of police vehicles, light alls, those are motor generators with lights on top, off the base. This caused me great concern. And I thought, this is the public relations disaster. What are we doing out here? And they kept telling me, "It's back in there. There's where it was." So four or five of us went forward, and we're searching through, and at that time, the lieutenant, who was the on-duty height commander, pointed out if something had sat down or landed, and we found three indentations equidistant apart, hard impressions down in the soil. And while we were looking at that and measuring them and taking readings with the APN-27, the Geiger counter, noticed marks on the trees. The trees were hotter, so to speak, had higher radiation readings on the inside toward the site, and each of the indentations had significant radiation, I'd say above background, and the center of the triangle formed by the three was even hotter. While we were measuring and marking, somebody said, "Look over there, we see something." And we looked back, and lo and behold, there was a large object. My guess is about 2-3 feet, maybe foot and a half in diameter, oval shaped, the black center, winking sort of like blink, 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 and dripping the equivalent of molten metal. And it moved about, moved to the left, moved to the right. At that time, we saw a significant reflection off the farmer's house that was beyond that. The lights were hitting it, and it appeared to be glowing, and so it was on fire, and I was quite concerned for the people that lived in the house. the object moved about, moved through the forest, and we tried to approach it. It came toward us at one point, it went away, and we see it back out into the field beyond where we were, toward the farmer's house, and it silently exploded into multiple white objects and disappeared. Well, we went forward, trying to find any evidence, looking on the ground, maybe perhaps something had fallen off and burned the ground, saw nothing. While we were looking about, we saw objects in the sky to the north and some to the south. The ones to the south seemed to be moving about and sending down the equivalent of beams of light. We went further forward, and at one point, beam came down almost directly at our feet, sort of like a laser. We stopped, and we were in awe, and we're thinking, wow, is this a warning? Is this a weapon? Is this a type of communication? What is this? We didn't know. And just as suddenly as it appeared, it disappeared. At the same time, we noticed an object over the WSA, the weapon storage area at Woodbridge, or Bentwaters, excuse me, appeared to be sending down beams too. At that time, we heard some communication on the radio that indicated they may have been doing that. I can't say that for a fact. We stayed out in the forest probably for another 2 or 3 hours and watched the objects. At one time, one came directly overhead. They moved about in sharp angular pattern, and they were there almost till dawn. Wow. We went back to the base, tired, wet, cold, and somewhat in shock.
You can imagine.
My biggest concern was, well, what are we going to tell people? Nobody will ever believe this. I went out to dispel this and saw something I don't believe. Mm-hmm. So what can I say?
Okay. Well, thank you, Colonel. Next I have on the list John Burroughs, but he does not seem to be with us. We will have a pre-record from him a little bit later. But let's move on to who we got next, Ben, here?
Oh, we have Steve. I cannot
pronounce Steve LaPlume. LaPlume. Yeah.
Tell us your story.
Correct.
Really bad at pronouncing things.
Okay. Well, I'm calling you from China, so I hope the line's hanging on okay here.
Well, sounds good.
Well, great, Steve. Well,
you sound great, Steve. Okay. Peter here.
Great, great. All right. Well, my incident basically happened about 3 shift rotations after after this incident on in late December. And what I saw was I was out with my commander at the time, or my shift commander, which was Senior Airman Palmer. And we were talking about the UFO incident. And lo and behold, in the southern sky, we saw it kind of looked like a satellite just cruising along, you know, just like when you look up in any sky and see a satellite cruising along. But it was suddenly started acting pretty erratically. It was going up and down in the sky. The elevations were something that no craft I know of can do, kind of like a heartbeat monitor. It was just bouncing up and down, and it was heading towards the east. Talked to Palmer about it for a second. He said, well, we're supposed to call stuff in like this. And he said, well, wait, let's see what's going on. So he ran down and went to the control tower to see what they had up in the air. He came back maybe 10, 15 minutes later at best and told them, well, we got a couple of the couple of helicopters up, a C-130, and there's nothing else up there. So obviously it wasn't one of these crafts who are completely incapable of those kind of maneuvers. So he said, okay, let's call it in. Okay, I agreed. And when he calls it in, he just basically he said, hey, you know, we had our call signs, and he just blurted out, hey, LaPlume just saw a UFO. I guess he didn't really get involved himself. And it wasn't a couple minutes later, and the security shack's phone rang, and from there pretty much it all hit the fan. I remember that Lieutenant England was a phone, asked me what I saw and where it went, whether we could still see it, which we couldn't. It went behind a small bank of clouds of a forest. So I informed him of that, and I believe that Colonel Hall was one of the first ones to show up, if not the first one, and he came from Bentwaters through the back gate, through the east gate, and I think he was driving a little sports car, a little British sports car at the time. And when Lieutenant England showed up, he informed me that Colonel Williams was on his way out there and that the colonel was now a general. He had just gotten a star. So here I am, a little, you know, immature little 17, just turned 18-year-old kid, and I've got more officers around me than I've seen in one place gathered at one time. So I was a bit on the nervous side. I do remember, and this I think is significant, is the fact that one of the commanders, and somebody's told me that it's Colonel Conrad, had brought out his wife and his child, and she had a Nikon camera around her neck. He was just very giddy about the fact that she might be able to go see a UFO and get a picture of it. The son was actually more reserved than she was. He seemed to be, I don't know, maybe in his teens, 17, 18. And they went off towards the forest. And I couldn't understand why they were heading towards the forest, because I really didn't have any knowledge of the incident, you know, back in December, other than I heard, you know, some of the SPs had gotten chased by a UFO. That's pretty much my only knowledge of it. So they went out. They went out into the forest. They came back a while later, so they couldn't find anything, and told us to, you know, keep an eye out. And I got posted on the east gate for the rest of the night. And Palmer went out, checked on the other police officers, came back. I don't know, maybe an hour later, we were talking about it, and then we saw a craft coming from the east over where the infamous lighthouse is. And unless lighthouses could fly, this light came over us, basically came up the road that's leading to the east gate. And I remember it was cigar-shaped. It was about the length of a football field, from what I remember. It was a very large craft. And when it was over my head, I do remember seeing lights, yellow, blue, and green, and it might have been red, but it was kind of in the peripheral. But I do remember focusing on a hatch on the bottom of this thing that was like a square within a square within a square. And I just remember telling myself, man, soak it in, because it's going to be one of the greatest things you've ever seen in your life. And a couple seconds later, it was off to the right and kind of heading towards the southwest. It went up into the sky and just basically blended in with the stars. And at that point, I kind of I was kind of in a fog, and I really don't remember even hearing anything at all. And I do remember that I looked over to Palmer. Palmer looked at me, because we were looking over the hood of the police cruiser. And he said, do you want to call this in? I said, hell no. And that's pretty much the last thing I ever spoke of it, Palmer or anybody else.
I wonder why.
We didn't tell anybody about it.
Can I ask you one question, Steve? What color was this thing?
You know, it just seemed like it was a dark color. I honestly don't remember. Okay. When I was looking at it when it was coming up, it seemed like it was just like a cloud or a fog around this thing.
Really?
And okay. My vision was very tunnel visioned. I don't remember, you know, having any massive peripheral vision like normal vision. I was just kind of focused on this thing, but it just okay. was dark in color.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you very much, Steve. We're going to get back to all this, of course, but I want to finish introducing everyone. We have Larry Warren. Larry Warren, of course, a co-author with Peter Robbins of the book Left at East Gate. And we're almost on top of a break, but why don't we get started, Larry? Why don't you tell your story? And if we got to take a break, we'll take a break, and we'll be right back with you afterwards.
Oh, very good. Can you hear me? I'm in England.
Yeah, you sound just as well.
Okay. I can't tell.
Yeah, okay.
Worldwide. All right. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on with the Colonel and Steve and the other fellas. I, with what I perceive and think and still do all these years later, is I was involved on the third night, or the night Colonel Holt was involved and made his tape, but at a different location in this field. And I was on B flight. I was new at the base. We just finished the incoming training, put on to our shifts, and I was picked up. Realize it's very long, so I know you're coming up to a break. Picked up by Lieutenant England, and Sergeant Adrian Bestinzen was driving a pickup truck, took me off a post on Bentwaters. Went to a motor pool on Bentwaters, and they were doing things with lightalls, which I was not familiar with why or what these things did at all. I was pretty new. Took them off to the east end of RAF Woodbridge, turned into the forest. Came to a clearing. We had weapons. It took them off us, armor. Went through the forest. Now, I do believe Lieutenant England probably joined up with Colonel Holt. I can't be sure of that. We went through the forest. They told us to maintain radio silence. There was Sergeant Bestinza and others were with me at this exact time. Get to a clearing, which, again, we didn't even know the name of this forest then. It was just the trees between the base. Get to a clearing. It was a misty yellow. It was a giant field, actually. It's not a little clearing in the woods. And a house that had a light on the upper floor, way out in the distance to the left. Red light appeared. There was a mist on the ground, like a ground fog that illuminated. Red light came in on an arc. It was south of where I'm familiar now where the Orford light is, and it was south of that. It was distant from it.
Okay, Larry, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to stop you, my friend. We've got to take a break here, but we'll be right back with you on the combined Paranormal and Caps Paranormal shows on this historic broadcast about UFOs. Stay with us. Yeah, right. Welcome back, everyone. Ben, did you want to take us over to our... Actually, no. What am I doing here? We were talking to Larry Warren, And Larry had to be interrupted by the break, which I'm sorry to say. So, Larry, if you want to continue with your story, let's do that. And
better by the break than a bullet.
Yeah.
So I'll condense it really quick because there's a lot of good fellas on here, and it is historic. You know, Mr. Holt's out there, you know, and saying what he's saying and doing what he's doing. It really is. It's amazing. So. Wherever I was, anyway, very controversial, my end. I do hope Mr. Holt brings up some of the mind control elements or some of the other fellows instead of me, just because it's me rolling it around here. Got to this field. There were some people with cameras. Sergeant Distinza said something. There was someone very upset, Robert Ball, who was our ship commander, if I recall. Again, this is 30 years. Was dealing with this person. It was very surreal. Memory is very fuzzy. It's very normal out to the point of the forest in the vehicles that I remember very well. When these events began, it is very dreamy, kind of, and maybe that would be. But there was an object, this red light came in over this misty thing on the ground, fog, but it wasn't floating above it. There was a flash of light and things that damaged my eyes that are documented. And it was all I can describe as a thing there on the ground. It kept changing its kind of shape, I guess, if you look at it. It was a large object. And separate to that object, the very controversial part of this is what I perceive and believe was something non-human. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's had nothing I wanted.
Yeah,
and it's a very hot issue with this thing.
Okay.
Negative, positive, negative. And it's been written about ad nauseum. I only wrote it one way in the book we did with Peter Robbins. I don't – what can you do? And okay. That's about it. I got back to the base, and where it really got worse. As a kid, I believed in this stuff. But at that point in my life, I was 19. I'm 50 next year, so I mean, a lot of years have gone on. You think about this every day, no matter what. But the real element to me that's important is not what it is. I have my own views, like everyone does. It's all we're left with is that simply that the feds, the spooks, the something, whoever runs the show on this subject got a hold of a bunch of us, and about to bring the mood down here, but I think some people should be in jail, or I'd like their addresses. That's mm-hmm. about it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Larry.
All right, and now for our experts. Bill Burns, please tell us about yourself and give us your basic comments on the Rendlesham case.
Well, I am the publisher of UFO Magazine, the host and consulting producer of History Channel's UFO Hunters, the host of FutureTheater.com radio. We investigated this case and really took up a lot with Charles Holt on UFO Hunters in season two, and we took up, or season one, and we took up a lot of the skeptics' arguments. And I think that one of the things that anybody who investigates this case realizes is that the skeptics and debunkers came right out of the woodwork. Americans are stupid. Americans didn't know what they were seeing. They were seeing the lighthouse at Orford Ness, which was reflecting with low-hanging clouds. There were no clouds that night, but nevertheless, that's exactly what was said, that the holes in the ground that where Charles Holt had the impressions taken, they were actually rabbit scrapings. So we actually went so far as to take every single skeptic's argument seriously and try and find some science, like Mythbusters, to see did the arguments hold any water. And what we found out was that the skeptics were dead wrong, that the arguments really did not hold any water. It could not have been the Orford Ness Lighthouse. It was in the wrong place. It could not have been rabbit scrapings, because rabbit scrapings go in at an angle. The impressions were straight down. Nobody accounted for the high radiation. Nobody accounted for the high radiation in the trees. And nobody could account for the repeat appearances of this. And if it were the Orford Ness light, why wouldn't that have been a regular occurrence every single night that light swept across the land, which, by the way, the light could not do because there was a metal bar keeping the light from sweeping across the land. So my impression is that this case was a real something. We don't know what the something is, but it was actually real. Something did land in Rendlesham Forest. Something did lead that Air Force team with Charles Holt on a merry chase through the forest. And the fact that you have that linear recording of Charles Holt's experience, seeing the lights in the sky, really says something about the fact that this is one of the only cases in UFO history where you have at-the-moment commentary on what's happening from the highest person in the U.S. military at that time to ever encounter something strange. The other person would have been Edward Ruppelt in Project Blue Book, but he was only an Air Force captain, not an Air Force lieutenant colonel. So that's fascinating. My one question to Charles Holt would be, were there any radar returns from any of the objects that the radar tower picked up that night?
Okay, actually, can we hold that just for about 2 minutes while we want to introduce Peter, of course, and then we're going to go to our discussion. Is that okay, Bill?
Sure.
Okay, and actually, Bill, we'll go right back to you when we start our discussion. You can pick that right up. Okay, we're going to move on to our final expert here, Peter Robbins. Peter, what? Tell us about yourself and what's your impression here?
I'm an investigative writer specializing in this subject, and first heard about the case, in autumn of 1983 when it broke in the British press. In 1984, I briefly met Larry Warren, who had just come forward under his name and was talking about some of his memories and experiences. And we re-met 3 years later at a conference in Washington, D.C., and before the end of that summer shook hands on working on a book about the subject. Larry's offer to me, I thought, was extremely even-handed. Here's all the information I have. You can interview me as much as you want. I will give you contact information for everyone else I know that was involved. And as long as I get to lay out my account in my own terms, you are free to find ways to support it with your research or to prove me wrong. And I thought, well, this is going to be an interesting year or so, and had no idea what I was getting myself involved in, quite frankly. The year turned into 9 years and about a dozen trips back to the United Kingdom with and without Larry, who I think was back more than I was in that time. And I've got to say, and Larry is knows this better than anybody, my only goal here was to try to get us a bit closer to whatever the truth is about this. And my agenda was that I really had no agenda. However, the chips fell, they fell. And Larry's account has borne up tremendously over the years. We were able to secure testimony of civilian as well as military eyewitnesses, winning people's trust in some cases over years. And one of the most extraordinary pieces of physical evidence, extensive soil analysis, with soil drawn from the location where the thing that Larry saw sat, and control samples in that farmer's field. It was fully according to scientific method reviewed by Springborne Environmental Laboratory in Massachusetts.
Okay, Peter, I'm sorry I have to interrupt. We have to take a break now. However, we'll be right back. We'll finish up. And right here on Behind the Paranormal, CAPS Paranormal Combined Shows. See you. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back, and we're finishing our introductions about 46 minutes into the show here. And I will remind you before we do that that you have anyone listening on the CBS website, newskyradio.com, has an instant feedback feature, and you feel free to use that. Also, Para X Radio, the chat room is open for business, and we also have a bunch of emails here. So we will try to get to your questions as we begin the panel discussion. But first, we want to finish hearing what Peter Robbins has to say. Peter Robbins, a co-author with Larry Warren of the book Left at East Gate. Peter, please continue where you were before the break, if you could, please.
Yeah, just to briefly cite the key points of the soil analysis of the site. The soil contained in excess of four times the amount of post-microscopic metallic particles that would naturally be found in the soil in that part of England. And what that suggested to our analyst was that a tremendous electromagnetic effect had been exerted on that area. The pH, so to say, was blown in the soil. It was very difficult for it to reconstitute with water to form good old English mud. Seed germination tests in every case with every kind of seed tried took longer to grow in the affected area than the control samples and always came up as a mutation. And finally, the trace element of sand in the soil, and 5 or 6 miles from the coast, so there should be some, was normal in the control samples. In the affected sample, it was, in the dispassionate terminology of the soil analyst, in an interim form of glass. I should also just add before relinquishing that our very first night of our very first visit, of many visits back to the location, Larry and I had a multiple UFO sighting and finally something coming down in the field near us, and it frightened the hell out of me. It also upset me more than I can say, because although some might ponder otherwise, the last thing I wanted was the character in this story. I was up on chronicling somebody else's experience, but not necessarily my own, and I really struggled with that for some time, and Larry and I had actually audio recorded this while it was happening, and those transcripts are not only put forward in the book, but in 1999, we were approached by readers who asked if they could conduct a voice stress analysis test on those first-generation audio cassettes. They did. They came up as absolutely authentic.
Wow.
I don't think there's a more important UFO story out there, and the preponderance, the huge number of key witnesses, a few of the best representatives are here with us, are all alive and well. It's not like Roswell.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Peter. Let me just remind everyone, too, that if you go to BehindTheParanormal.com, our show website, there is a Talking Points page, which will have some illustrations of the craft and some other information, and also the book, and you can buy the book through the link there. Okay, I know that we have a pre-record from John Burroughs, who was unable to be with us live tonight. He's in transit. However, I'd like to kind of get going on the panel discussion at this point, and then we can play the Burroughs recording as we go, if that's okay with everybody. So why don't we open it up? We have Bill Burns from UFO Magazine had a question for Colonel Halton. Bill, why don't you start us off tonight with that question?
Sure. I've got actually two questions, one for Colonel Halt and one for Peter Robinson and Larry Warren. The question to Charles Halt is, were there any radar returns on those nights indicating strange objects in the airspace over RAF Bentwaters? That's question one to Charles Halt. And the question to Larry Warren, Peter Robbins, is when you did the soil analysis on that forest soil, was the soil impervious to water? Because that would remind me of the Delphos, Kansas case from a few years earlier. But the radar question would be first, because that's the most obvious.
Colonel?
I can answer the question. I continually, on the command net, called the command post, asked to contact Eastern Radar, who had radar surveillance and air defense responsibility for that area, and they had difficulty, they told me, finding anything on the tape or on the screen, so to speak. But later I was told that there were some response, but I was never able to verify that, and I was never able to verify the recordings of that screen. They were available anywhere. So I don't know what happened, but I do know what we saw.
Okay, very good. And thank you, Colonel. Bill, you had a question for Peter and Larry as well?
Yeah, the question for Peter and Larry really was the soil analysis, that when you mm-hmm. – we know about the radiation. Now, we know about the radiation in the trees, but the soil analysis is fascinating. I'm curious about the imperviousness of the sandy soil to water.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me first tell you this, Bill. We observed this on our first trip back about 8 years and almost 3 months after the incidents had happened. I was able to collect professional samples of soil for analysis on the following trip back in the June of 1990. And that required the collection of pounds of soil. I don't know if those background beta and gamma traces would have held up after almost 10 years, but I can tell you from my own experience of doing the simplest experiment of getting two equal-sized jar lids, putting an equal amount, a tablespoon or so, of affected and controlled soil in each, an exact amount of water in each, and stirring it up and working it, that the affected sample, the soil either just went right to the bottom or floated on the top like dust, and even a minute or two of trying to work it like an apothecary did not change that. Now, whether or not there are actual physiological similarities between that and the Delpos case you're talking about, I don't know.
Peter, I can only tell you that when we were in Phyllis Budinger's lab in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, looking at the Delpos, Kansas soil, that soil behaved exactly the way you've just described the soil from Rendlesham Forest. In other words, you could not mix water and that soil. It's as if the soil were rejecting water completely. And of course, as you suggested, nothing would grow. Seeds would not germinate. And she tried to do that. Seeds would not germinate in that soil. And of course, as you know from the photos of the Delpos, Kansas ring, that soil kept on generating light, some kind of a light return for years after that case was over.
Okay.
Can I interject something?
Yeah.
Yeah, Colonel Hall.
Can I interject something?
Please, sir, go ahead.
When I went back numerous times before 1990 and after 1990, the Forest Service people continually told me that the site Larry Warren identified, and where I guess Larry and Peter took their samples from, was several hundred yards away. And the forest where I actually encountered the indentations was growing very normally, in my opinion. I don't mean to rain on your parade, but...
Well, no rain perceived. I can only tell you, and this is a very human, unspun observation, when Larry and I returned there for the very first time, I had been doing my reading and the like for about 7 months. We were going to a place I now knew in my mind, Capel Green, the farmer's field that you're familiar with. And as we got to the point where we were coming through the woods and clearing them enough where we could see the field now and the stand of trees pretty much straight ahead of us, the farmer's house off to the left, and the spot that Larry identified was about between the edge of the field and the stand of trees where we were coming out of at that point, his arm shot out reflexively automatically, and he said it sat about there. And we're recording this while it's happening. This is just a living human moment here. And he's quiet for a minute, and then he says, but of course that's a coincidence that spot is kind of oval and discolored. And my feeling was, yeah, it is a coincidence. I never jumped to conclusions, and it could have been a lightning strike or a play of light or fertilizer that had not been graded out. But as the afternoon wore on and we walked into it and drew samples, you could see, you could feel the difference. Now, again, I don't know exactly what location you are referring to here, but all I can tell you was that identifying that spot that second and never wavering from it and having that spot in photographs taken in 88 and 90, distinctly pronounced, backed up by those extraordinary test results, suggests to me that something actual happened on that spot and that that is the spot that Larry remembered. I guess we'll have to go out there together to...
Peter, I'm sorry, we're going to have to wrap it up. Okay, we're going to wrap up our first hour, folks. We will be back to continue this fascinating discussion on the Rendlesham UFO case of 1980, and we'll be turning the driver's seat over to the CAPS Paranormal Fellas. But stay with us. We'll be right back. You don't want to miss this.
From our universe to yours, this is Psychic Radio.
We know you're listening.
Log on to psychiconair.com.
Hey. Welcome to this very special edition of the Para-X Radio Show. This is Dave.
And this is Tom. And everyone listening, this is the UFO extravaganza, if anything.
It certainly is. And we are so thankful to be here with you tonight. And we hope that we have transferred from the first hour where Paul and Ben Eno did a remarkable job of moderating the panel. And, of course, we want to welcome back Paul and Ben to our show. Welcome back, guys.
Oh, thank you very much. Ben's taking a break here.
Oh, he is. Okay.
I'm trying to get our panel back.
Yeah, we're working on that, folks. We got a little bit of a problem connecting. That'll happen here in just a little bit. We'll make sure everything works out all right. Just want to mention again, folks, we have a terrific panel that's here tonight talking about the Rendlesham Forest incident. It's been termed the British Roswell incident. And to be honest, Tom and Paul, I think it actually goes beyond Roswell in a lot of respects. Roswell was shaded in a lot of mystery from the beginning. Many of the witnesses that were there at the original thing that happened with Roswell have gone now. And here we are talking to these gentlemen who actually witnessed the incident. Not only that, there is a plethora of data that's out there that was collected. We have an audio tape from Chuck Holt talking about the initial investigation when he went out there with all these folks. And, of course, we have Steve LaPlume is with us. I want to go through this panel very quickly if I can while we're still trying to achieve communications back. First of all, we've got, of course, Bill Burns is with us, who is the editor of UFO Magazine and also the host of History Channel's UFO Hunters. We're glad to have Bill with us. Also, we have Peter Robbins is with us and Larry Warren, who have co-authored a book which was the definitive, I believe, book on the Rendlesham Forest incident, Lift at East Gate. And if you get a chance to get that book, certainly do that. As Paul mentioned, if you want to go to Behind the Paranormal's website, they have a link where you can get that book. Also, we have an audio tape from John Burroughs, who couldn't join us live tonight, so we'll try to get that in as soon as we can if we get an opportunity. Also, we have, as I mentioned, Steve LaPlume is with us, who was an eyewitness to the incident that happened out there. So we want to welcome all of those folks to the show tonight, and we're looking forward to a terrific time of sharing what I believe is the definitive UFO incident. And it's very strange, Tom, that here in the United States we don't hear much about it.
It is. I mean, like you touched on earlier, is that if you mention Roswell, everybody knows about Roswell in the United States, but this incident, they don't. It was just like more of a hush-hush over here, I guess.
Yeah, and of course, you know, one of the things, and it's true about America, it's really true about everyone, I guess, in their own countries, is that, well, if it happened over there, it really doesn't affect us. But what is happening now is that as folks reflect back on some of the things that happened there, and of course, having an opportunity for these folks to tell us about the incident brings it back into the consciousness of all Americans now. So now we're starting to understand just how global this incident is. And we appreciate, of course, Bill Burns being with us tonight. And, Bill, we thank you for being here. Bill, how do you what perspective do you put this incident am I on track as far as the importance of it possibly being even greater than the Roswell incident?
Well, the fascinating thing about this case is that while Roswell is interesting in American history, and because of the fact that not only what the witnesses said and what Walter Haupt, the public information officer, said in his affidavit, in his deathbed affidavit about the case, but what's fascinating is that even though Roswell was a cover-up after a cover-up of a cover-up, right, the Bentwaters case kind of showed that the United States Air Force was still in the loop on UFO investigations, even though they publicly disclaimed UFO investigations in 1969. So for the MOD, the British Ministry of Defense, to hand off the case to the Americans and say, look, this is your Air Force base, your soldiers, your airmen, and your personnel. Here, you investigate it. It's a hot potato for us. We don't want to touch it. And the Air Force takes Charles Holt's report, and Charles Holt can certainly comment on this better than I can, Charles's report, and all the other data that came from the investigation. And then when you listen to Larry Warren's debriefing stories and how these airmen personnel were treated, it took all of that. And we haven't heard one word since officially from the Air Force. It really tells you more about the case, or at least as much about the case, as it did about Roswell. So that's the importance of that case in terms of American ufological history.
Well, it certainly is. You know, something I want to ask you, Bill, since we have you on here, as we're trying to get the other panelists on, because we appreciate your input into the discussion tonight. As you mentioned, the Britons tried to push it off on the Americans because it's an American thing. You know, American soldiers, even though it's at RAF air bases. Do you feel that maybe that might have been pre-planned, thinking that, all right, since we know that Project Blue Book has been closed, that they would automatically, as they kicked it to the Air Force, it would be buried? Do you think that there was that much planning in place where they were just trying to put this thing under wraps as quickly as possible?
No, I don't think so. I think that when you listen to Nick Pope, and he was on UFO Hunters as well in this episode, when you listen to Nick Pope talk about this, you come to the conclusion that UFOs and UFO cases are hot potatoes. And they're like serial killers. Serial killers are in plain sight, but no police agency wants to admit there's a serial killer because you can't solve the case. Well, it's the same thing with UFOs. They're in plain sight, and nobody wants them. They're hot potatoes. So the British used any excuse they possibly could not to spend one thin dime or one thin tuppence to investigate the case. They gave it to the Americans. The Americans have a standard procedure. Don't ask, don't tell. So basically, they just took it under wraps and said, we're not going to say a thing about it, never responded to Charles Holt, never responded to Larry Warren or anybody else seeking information. Now we have the letter. We actually have the document from the MOD to the United States Air Force. So I would say anybody listening out there can simply take that letter. It's online. You can find it. And file a Freedom of Information request to the Air Force, specifically referencing the letter from the MOD by date, by number, by whatever document number it has, and ask them for any information pursuant to that letter from the MOD and see what you get back from the Air Force.
Okay. And you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom. Pardon me.
Oh, no, it's Paul. I'm sorry.
Okay. Sorry, Paul. Pardon me.
And I was going to suggest the studio was trying to get the fellows back. We're missing Charles. This is really, really strange. You know, this kind of stuff happens whenever we deal with this. All kinds of odd things begin to happen. Will could tell you some stories. We're trying to get back Colonel Charles Holt, Larry Warren, and Peter Robbins. And let's see if we can do that. But in the meantime, if you fellows you want to play the John Burroughs tape, we can do that. It's up to you.
Did you want to go to some of the questions?
Maybe we should go to some of the questions. It's up to you, fellas. It's your show.
I've got a quick question. This is from CC from California, Bill. Oh, this is for both of you. Are there a British equivalent of the Men in Black in the United Kingdom?
Yes, there are. The Ministry of Defense has its own investigators. Now, when you talk about Men in Black, what you're really talking about are people who go out to do two things. Collect evidence and suppress any statements from witnesses, probably for the purposes of national security. The Brits have their own equivalent of Men in Black, except they're probably, I don't know, in turquoise or something. But they have their own equivalent of that. Investigators who say to witnesses, look, thank you for the information and don't say anything else.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, as you mentioned before, they wanted to push this off. They didn't want to deal with it. Didn't want to spend the funds. Didn't want their hands dirtied with it, as it were. But yet they still have this entity within the government to do research on UFOs.
Well, sure they do, because UFOs, I mean, another case, not to detract from this case, but this case is critical because Woodbridge and Bentwaters were also the subject of a big, big 1956 UFO case in which Venom fighters were dispatched to track down and shoot down a couple of UFOs out in the North Sea. So this has happened before in this area. But years after, 13 years later, Bentwaters was the Cosford incident. And again, a UFO, an object, we don't know what it was, over-restricted British airspace, clearly a threat to the impunity of that airspace, to the integrity of that airspace, and the British asked the Americans, what planes are you testing? And the Americans said to the British, what planes are you testing?
We've got to go to break. I apologize, Bill. We've got to go to break, and folks, we'll be right back. This is Para-X Radio on New Sky Radio, powered by CBS.
And welcome back to Caps Paranormal Radio and Behind the Paranormal, dual shows tonight on Psychic Radio powered by CBS AOL, and Yahoo. And Dave, I have got chat room question after chat room question for these guys.
Yes, indeed. And let me go back. We finally restored communication. So I want to, you know, it's
Mothership agreed with us.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great that we have live radio. We love it and we hate it at the same time. But we got all these great folks with us and we appreciate it. We're going down the line as best I can here. I appreciate Colonel Charles Halt that's with us, Bill Burns, also Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. Steve LaPlume is with us in the studio. Also, Paul and Ben Eno from Behind the Paranormal. And I hope I mentioned everybody. So welcome, folks, back to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome back.
All right. Thank you. Tom.
One of the questions I've got, well, the chat room. Again, if you've got a question and you're listening somewhere else, go to para-x.com, click on live chat. That will throw you into the chat room. You can private chat me a question, and I'll get it to these guys ASAP. One of the questions earlier was, were there any burn marks on the trees or in the grass around the site?
The site I approached with
Bruce Ingram. Colonel Hall we're listening to.
Yes.
I did not see any burn marks anywhere, just rub marks, I guess, on the trees is the best way. I was later told by the Forest Service they were blaze marks, but I'm not really convinced, but that's their story.
Okay. And something else I want to throw in there, too, Colonel, if I could, while we have you here. Not that we're going to lose you again, but tell me, you mentioned that you grabbed a Geiger counter when you went out, when you were called. Is that standard issue to do that whenever you see one of these anomalies?
No. I did not grab a Geiger counter. I got the disaster preparedness NCO, who was a standby guy, to go get an APN-27, which was the standard machine we used at that time, to take along. He was also a professional photographer, and I said, bring your camera, the Geiger counter, we're going to disprove all of this.
Okay, and I got a quick follow-up from the chat room. They were talking about Geiger counters earlier in the chat room. They wanted to know, did anyone determine what radioisotope it was? And if they did pick anything up, could it have been from spacecraft propulsion or from space travel or solar radiation?
All we would do is read alpha, beta, and gamma radiation. I can't tell you anything other than that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is for Steve LaPlume. Of course, Steve is an eyewitness to what happened out there. And, of course, Steve, your take on this thing is somewhat different than everyone else's because it was a different time period, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yeah. I just want to clear that up. I wasn't a witness to the December incident. Mine was about 3 weeks later, four weeks later. Okay. And the reason I believe mine's significant is because it shows the demeanor of the people, the officers, when they showed up. They didn't seem like they had any idea or any foreknowledge of UFOs and any involvement, any prior involvement. I mean, they were out there like anybody else, like, wow, let's go see what we see. Am I coming across correctly?
You are. And that's a great thing about this thing, Steve. Of course, this is Steve LaPlume. Steve, one of the things that you said earlier on in the previous hour, which I really loved it, by the way, because it sounds so human, what you said, is that, you know, you thought, man, this is a monumental event. I'm getting to see something that not everybody in the world gets to see. So this was the thought that you were carrying when you were seeing all this, is that you knew this was something that was extraordinary, not a lighthouse blinking at you.
Oh, absolutely. And plus, I was looking straight up. My neck was craned backwards, looking up at the bottom of an object. You know, I mean, and I was just in complete awestruck of this craft.
And you felt no threat, you felt no danger to yourself or those around you.
I had an M16 on my shoulder, and if I felt threatened, I didn't use it anymore.
No threat at all.
Yeah. Yeah, we learned not to point those things and shoot them at stuff that flies a long time ago. Tom.
Yes, another chat room question, and we had talked about this earlier as well. Could all the lights that were seen been from a helicopter?
That's a Charles Hall question, right?
I believe it is, yes.
I believe it is.
Yes. Are you still with us, Colonel?
Hello?
Yeah, there you are. Right there with us, Colonel.
As far as I'm concerned, absolutely not a helicopter. I know what a helicopter looks like. This had no rotors, no sound. I mean, unless they've got completely soundless helicopters, absolutely not. I think it was like 1,000 feet over my head.
Yeah, good point. Because, you know, one of the things that gets missed on folks, and this is particularly for Colonel Halt and also for Steve and Larry and all those that serve in the military, is that you suddenly just didn't forget all your previous experiences. you know, because you go out here and you see something like this, this is totally extraordinary. And everybody says, oh, I could have, you know, it's some guy playing a prank with a police car. It was a helicopter. It was a lighthouse flipping around out there and illuminating the surrounding area. As if you guys have never seen anything up until this point that has a military connotation to it. And to me, that's what makes this so compelling, what you're telling us tonight, is that you guys know what the natural causes would be, and yet you're saying, I know what folks think it might have been, but based on my own experiences, here's what I saw. Larry, what do you think about that? Have we got Larry?
He might have dropped.
Oh, okay.
You know, if I can just add, this is Peter.
Sure.
From an investigative point of view, and I wasn't there, but when you get one solid account after another, and there are historic evidences of events like this happening in the area, and then the paper chase reveals documentation supporting the reality of the event, these excuses, which the most recent one was a manure truck that was on fire, would be laughing. They would be funny if they weren't so extraordinarily insulting to the intelligence of these men. The late debunker Phil Klass suggested that some of the men involved, you know, may have been smoking marijuana, and, you know, you see things when you do that. This is a highly secured military situation. We're talking about the commission of a crime of jeopardizing, you know. Anyway,
yeah.
That kind of response is so cavalier, and the whole lighthouse thing is for me, below contempt.
Sure, and I think one of the reasons why I mentioned this, and Colonel, welcome back with us, and also, Larry, thank you for being back with us. We apologize that it drops in and out, so we will
keep cutting each other off.
Oh, are you? Oh, I'm sorry. But anyway, and this is for Colonel Halt. In your tape that you have, which is a very compelling piece of evidence, if you get a chance to listen to that, folks, it's pretty obvious to me that you guys are not running a script out there. You know, this is something you've happened upon that it has no natural reason for it happening, and you can tell that by your voices. But one of the things that gets thrown out there is that there is a it sounds like a soldier is in the background saying, "There it is again. There it is again," talking about the light, and he's doing this every 5 seconds. And some detective or whatever has said, "Well, that's the natural cycle of the lighthouse. Is every 5 seconds the beam comes back around." And how would you answer somebody who says that to you?
Very simply, we were looking at two objects. The lighthouse is off to the right, and the object is in the field behind, in front of the farmer's house. Now, Bruce England, that's whose voice that is, was probably also looking at the lighthouse. The object in the field was reflecting off the farmer's windows brightly, so much that I was concerned for the occupants of that house. Now, you tell me how a lighthouse 3 or 4 miles out to the coast would reflect off the windows.
Indeed.
It's very simple. I've had a long tirade with Ian Ridpath. You probably have heard of him.
He
won't go away with a lighthouse. I'm going to tell him, go buy the lighthouse if you want it. This object moves through the forest horizontally, bobbing up and down vertically, and avoiding trees before it receded into the farmer's field. Now, that was no lighthouse. Lighthouses are affixed. That's all I want. I get frustrated when I hear that. I just get tired of it. I've talked to the lighthouse operator. It's shielded. You can see a reflection, but you do not see it directly. But what can I say? A couple of things I need to have before we get cut off again.
Hopefully it won't
happen. Plume saw something. He and Wendell Palmer reported to law enforcement. I told him if they ever see anything again, to call me. And they did. I responded, and I called Gordon Williams, who was the wing commander. He had a staff car and had to drive all the way around. I had a Triumph TR8 convertible, and it fit underneath the pipe gates, and I was able to drive down across the runway, called the tire, cleared for crossing, and went directly out there. And by the time I got there, whatever they saw was gone, and Gordon Williams responded. So Steve LaPlume did see something, according to what he told me he and Wendell Palmer did. There was nobody else present at that time. So
wonderful. And I also... Yeah, I also want to say you have great taste in automobiles, sir.
I wish I kept the car.
Yeah, I wish I did too. Tom.
Can I throw in an email question
absolutely.
Here?
Absolutely.
Okay, Paul Eno speaking. This is for anyone on the panel. It's from Peter in Columbia, South America. And Peter says, or asks, please share the complete dialogue that occurred between the base personnel and the entities. The question of contact. And also, what was the result of the recent analysis of the symbols on the UFO? That's a question just for anybody on the panel.
Could I just say one thing? Because I got cut off, and I'll shut up. I've had 30
years.
Go
right ahead, man.
No, man. I've had 30 years of fun with this. I got more experience of the BS factor with all the people that deal with this kind of subject than any of them. So get ready for a ride, boys. And I do. My biggest regret is back in 81 or 82 is that the only place you could go is to the UFO world with this. And, because the public just wasn't grooving on this kind of thing. But Colonel Halt said something. This is only because I was cut off. So I just want to complete this statement. It's very complex events. The soil analysis that we did, I stayed all the way out of that. I have no idea how you do soil analysis and could frankly give a darn. But it was done. It was done through professional people. Scientists, not ufologists, and sorry, but it wasn't. It was, we went outside the bubble for that, and that was Peter's doing, not mine. I was just trying to survive in a marriage at that point. When the colonel mentioned that, I guess, the site in the woods, or I believe there were two sites in the woods, from the first night, and that the forestry people told them that the growth there is normal, and that they may have, I'm sure they've said that to him. But I think that was the same forestry commission that commented on the initial landing sites that involved Burroughs, Peniston, and Cabana Stack, saying that the triangular indentations were caused by rabbits or chickens burrowing in the night to stay warm. So I would be very suspect anything the British Forestry Commission has to say on just about anything except planting trees. I'll shut up now.
Okay, well, that's burrowing chickens. That's an interesting idea.
Very
interesting. Chickens.
Yeah, but of course, the issue is contact here. Was there any? Well, just begin to answer Peter's question here. Was there any contact between base personnel and life forms of some kind?
I say yes. I say yes myself, and I do. It's Larry.
It's Larry speaking.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, this thing is hotter than a lot of lights flying around and things like that. There's a big thing here. And then there was a lot of meddling with a lot of young guys serving. And La Plume out there, my old brother, we didn't know each other at the time, all this stuff. But let me tell you, now, Colonel Holt's running an air base. We were guys just out of high school and under him and working on that base. And that the big crux of this is a lot more than I think certain people would go. And I stood up at the National Press Club many years ago now, raised my hand, said under perjury, threat of perjury, going to prison or whatever they want to do, that I would say what I say. Now, if it is all wrong, then someone has to dispute the people with me as liars or meddled with, I mean, which I think is a factor after the fact, and then basically has to dispute the scientific analysis of the spot in the field. Now, I'm not an expert on any of that, and I'm not saying I'm right on any particular thing. My only desire, it was an unconscious thing, and it took a life of its own because there's a reality to these events, else it would have gone away a long time ago. You definitely don't want a tag on this thing on your head, but it affected a lot of people. And La Plume can tell you from the guys in the barracks that went through this or the peripheral, there was a lot of strange stuff on that base afterwards. There was a lot of, I use the word spooks, I don't know them. There was a lot of incorrect stuff going on, and they were doing stuff with us, the people. And it was very, very wrong. And
okay, well,
I'm not going to
let
you. Just my opinion.
All right, well, we got to wrap. I'm going to give it back to Dave. It's his show here, but I'm not going to let this go.
Okay, yeah, you hang on to that, Paul, because I want to hear this as well, and we'll be right back after this break. This is a joint show tonight with the Para X Radio and also with Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Benino on Para X Radio, powered by CBS through New Sky Radio.
And welcome back to Caps Paranormal and Behind the Paranormal on Psychic Radio, powered by CBS, AOL, and Yahoo. And Dave, I think Bill Burns has a question for the guys.
Yeah, I think also we've got, I think it was Peter, was it Peter and Larry, I think, that were making a statement, and we had to go to break. So I want to go back to that first if we can. So sure. If you can complete your thought, okay. We don't want to cut it off on you.
All right, well, if it was me,
I think I just said what I had to say that, just on that. I'm sorry. I'm okay.
I think there was going to be a response back to what you were saying, Larry. I don't know if it was by Peter or who it was, and I apologize.
I think Colonel Holt wanted to say something.
Ah, indeed. Okay, there we go.
Okay. May I speak now?
Certainly. You're ready.
Okay. I don't dispute anything Larry says. I do not think Larry was directly involved. Larry was in the background, perhaps. I think Larry was, how shall I say, significantly abused along with several other people. I think they were subjected to hypnosis, sodium pentothal, and perhaps some interaction from something that we don't understand. And I sincerely believe that some of what they think and believe is disinformation designed to make the whole event appear too ridiculous. Now, that being said, something significant did happen, and Larry may have been there. I'm not disputing that he may have been there. But I do know that Peniston and Burroughs are definitely very, very badly confused, have significant mental problems, perhaps physical problems, and I don't know about Ed Kavanasak. So that being said, we can go from there.
All right, sir. And I'd like to follow up with that if I could, because it's a powerful statement that you just made.
I've got radiological issues from exposure to an unshielded nuclear device here, burns to the retinas, two marriages down the drain, which happens in life, a whole bunch, a truckload of weird stuff in the head for the last 30 years. And you know what? I've heard that times just about everyone involved. In fact, and I'm not being hostile here at all. I have a lousy throat tonight. Forgive me. I sound like Satan on the radio. But at the end, I really mean no harm here. And I agree with Colonel Holt. And respect Colonel Holt. I'm not trying to dominate anything. And in fact, I'm so thrilled other people can come along and become punching bags for the UFO community and the media at large. And I hope they don't take the crap these people dish out. But at the end of the day, I was recently in Nevada, and it was fascinating to me is that these older people, older than I, approached me. And this woman was the only female POW in the Vietnam War. And the other gentleman was a fighter pilot. And they were very good friends with Gordon Williams, who was our wing commander. And I filled in and did a talk. It wasn't even planned anyway. They sat down and told me a number of things, which I'm not being mysterious. I just won't get into it here because it's secondhand. But it was fascinating to me. And I showed some documents, one being here. And years ago when Charles Holt met with us in Washington, I think I showed him some of this stuff. I don't remember now. But one of my documents, my approval for discharge, I was not in the military a long time, like these gentlemen, is that it was approved by Gordon Williams. And I asked this gentleman, he actually handled it. And I asked this gentleman on the front row who is friends with him, and I said, and he was an officer like Colonel Holt and the rest, and they understand the military better than me. And I said, is this correct? Would this happen? And he just shook his head. So that's just one little thing, you know. And I'm with Colonel Holt on the meddling and the things, and I would love to go visit the folks that did things like that. That's all. Shut up.
Oh, no, that's
no, no, that's great. No, I think Bill Burns had a question for the guys earlier.
Well, my question really was for Colonel Holt, and without naming names, and I know you can't do that, you can't disclose names, but it was true, was it not, that the entire event was witnessed from a WSA tower by a third party from that surveillance tower who basically confirmed exactly the interaction that took place in the forest?
There was a person from the 2164th Comm Squadron who was up there working. In fact, both nights, first and the third night, because they were having some electronic problems, and he has verified the events as they occurred, I guess is the best way to put it.
So, I mean, what you have is not just the eyewitness testimony, which, as Larry Warren has mentioned, could have been affected by actual events that night or could have been affected by events perpetrated by the military subsequent to the event. But you also have a third party who is not affected verifying this entire thing.
Well, there's another party involved that's very interesting. One of the senior pilots who is a golfing partner, or has been for years, with Gordon Williams, was in the air traffic control tower the night I was out there monitoring some things and overheard most of the conversations and witnessed the whole event. Would you believe that?
That's incredible.
That's recently come out. I know who he is, but I'm not going to give you his name.
Oh, no, of course not. But I'm just saying, when you look at that, when you look at the fact that you're not talking about simply the witnesses that were there, important because they're firsthand and they interacted, you're talking about people out of the loop who saw this. So that's very powerful evidence as to the veracity of this event.
I've got a lot of problems with some people have really been meddled with so badly that some of the facts have been significantly distorted, I guess is the best way to put it. But there may have been more than two nights. I can't say there weren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that would also maybe I know that there is a distinct discrepancy, I guess is the best way to put it, between Beniston and what Burroughs have said about when they came upon the scene, is that Beniston was talking about touching the craft 45 minutes. Hit the deck, it took off through the trees. So the reasons why that there's a divergence of testimony in this regard because of the possibility of meddling with some of the witnesses of the event?
I think there was some meddling both by, how should I say, the powers to be plus some powers we don't understand.
Well, sure. I would agree with Colonel Hall, too, in that when you read Larry Warren's account of the event, what you take away from that is that there was something about the field that was being generated by the object itself that was it's called the Oz effect, that was interfering with the cognitive abilities of people who were witnesses and, again, were affected by it. You slow down, you get disoriented, you lose a sense of the passage of time. And that also affects your ability to remember with any complete accuracy the sequence of events.
I think some of this stuff, and this won't make sense, but maybe the Colonel will. And Peter, I think I've mentioned it to you at one time or another. Mm-hmm. But I think some of this was already in the works when I was still in Texas, and that was in the summer of 80. There were some very strange things, and I know the Colonel's working with Gary Hazeltine, a wonderful researcher over here, a police detective, on this event, and I wish them well with what they're trying to accomplish. But I discussed it with Gary, and you get old and you start looking back and going, that's not making sense to me. But I doubt it ever will. But there is definitely with this meddling, and then other things going on. If someone did read our book, they would see that through, and I'm kind of skeptical on regressive hypnosis and all the hoo-hoo that go with that, but I did one with someone I trust, and that was, and Peter was present, with Bud Hopkins. This came out of a very, very clinical situation, not the Sci-Fi Channel kind of a thing, very disturbing, very invasive with people, you know. And but I'm not alone with that, and I think all of us are victims at a certain level here. And I am with the Colonel also that there's something even beyond the spook level of things with this that has pulled the strings, I think, for many, many years.
I agree as well. This is Peter, and after being most familiar with Larry's account, but speaking with other men and. A number of our listeners have seen clips from John Burroughs' sessions with his therapist. I think he's been very courageous to release them, either in lectures with Linda Moulton Howe, who he's been working with, or on her own or on his own. And they show somebody struggling against something that they're very frightened of. There's a factor of shock that enters into any kind of extremely non-standard situation, and I agree with basically everything that's been said here in terms of external influencing with pretty nefarious purposes from very likely us and them across the board with all of the legitimate witnesses in this category. All the more reason to try to help give an opportunity to hear all of the pieces of those puzzles. And, you know, I'm sorry John couldn't join us live tonight, but I really wish him the best in resolving this situation that he keeps hitting up against. And Larry and I were watching part of this, a fragment from this hypnotic regression last September in Liverpool. And it was tremendously disturbing to everybody in the audience, and so much so for Larry that he had to walk out of the room.
Yes.
But, yeah, everybody's been meddled with on a certain level, or the aspects of physiological shock have to be calculated in on top of everything else.
Sure.
Could I just say one thing very quick that the Colonel brought up? Is maybe the intention with some of the meddling, and I'm not a scientist, doctor, or anything. I don't know. I understand these things can be done. But,
yeah, but hang on to that thought, and we'll bring you right back with it. I apologize. We've got to take a break, but we'll bring you
right
back. Hang on to it. We appreciate it. Folks, we'll be right back after this break. This is Para-X Radio in cooperation with Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno on Sky Radio, powered by CBS.
And welcome back to Caps Paranormal and Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno on Psychic Radio, powered by CBS, AOL, and Yahoo. And, Larry, we had to cut you off at break. We're going to let you go ahead and... go ahead with your question.
Thanks. I was just going to say, you know, I know that Colonel Hall's position with, you know, some of us were, well, it's not in position. He's right, and I know it, and that we were meddled with at some point or another. And I've always said, I do believe that if, you know, some of us were sent out, you know, it's like the, you know, the thing that got through and try to keep this down. I remember telling friends about this in 81 when I got home, and they're all laughing at me, and I just shut up, you know. And I'm not from a family where this is kind of a subject that was talked about at all. Not at all. And I'd say if that was the mission of the human element, the nefarious bunch that did the naughty on us, I'd say it didn't really work, because here we all are. And it's a great step. I can end up being wrong on 90%, but I think we're all victims. I'm definitely one, too. But I don't think it worked. I mean, we're here. And the more guys are talking about things, the pieces of the puzzle for us even personally comes together. And maybe we go on the ground many, many years from now with a little more peace of mind.
That's yes, indeed. And something I want to mention, too, before we go on, because there was a great statement that was made during break, and I want folks out there to listen very carefully when I say this. This is a human story, and it really is. When you think about all that these gentlemen have gone through because of a happenstance incident that they happen to be in either the right or the wrong time, place at the wrong time, it's a very human story. So please don't let the flying saucers and the little green man and the radiation and all that compel you more than the human story with this. So I just wanted to throw that out. Tom, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I've got a question for Peter Roberts.
Can I say something here?
Oh, sure. Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. Yeah, this is, like I said, this is Steve LaPlume. I'm sorry, I've got a bit of a bad connection over here when it comes to listening. But, you know, I joined the Air Force for 6 years. I spent less than a year in the Air Force. The reason being, I was drummed out of the Air Force for on my own account because, as Larry said, you know, people were messing with us over there. I was tailed and followed, and I confronted two agents, which I believe were some sort of agents, in the All Ranks Club.
I remember that night, dude, in the All Ranks Club.
Right.
Indeed.
And when I confronted them, they left out of the back of the All Ranks Club, got in a dark sedan, and took off. And at that point, I said, hey, you know, I'm into something here that I really don't, you know, I felt my life was threatened at that point. So I formulated a plan. The reason I got out of the Air Force was because I took a knife to my stomach and cut it open and faked a suicide attempt. Okay? And
yeah.
I mean, it's pretty out of character for me. Okay, that's why I got out of the Air Force, because I figured that was an easier way out than having to deal with what was going on at the time. So when you're saying that it's a very human event, it's a pretty big understatement. You know, I kind of
but now,
I want to
oh,
my career.
But now, yeah, but now, Steve, what you and Larry have just attested to, and I'm going to kind of respond to Larry when you say, well, what they tried to do didn't work. Steve, what they tried to do got you out of the Air Force. You did it by your own hand, but that was your way out. And Larry, as you know, this meddling that has taken place has really affected your life in certain kinds of ways. So quite frankly, what I would say is that so anybody looking at records would say, oh, Larry Warren, look at the problems he's had. Oh, Steve, look at the problems he's had. He tried to take his own life. The point is what they, and we can answer who they is, try to do is marginalize people who report these events, even if these events, as in the case of Larry and Charles Holt and Steve LaPlume, even if these events are right and the Jim Peniston are right in your face, they will marginalize you. And so when you do tell the story, you're telling it from the point of view of the guy on the street corner who's marginalized, and because if this were not marginalized, you would have this to be a common shared experience and a common understanding that these things are real. It's not. And that's why they've succeeded to this point.
Yeah, I always often wonder when Steve and I were just at a high school event, and we just a brief breeze in the wind, you know, of us being in the Air Force and on that base. You know, like an idiot, I had the last guaranteed country of choice, which was here. And why that is so impacting on us still 30 years later, there's something to be wondered about there. Just that one little brief moment. Very strange.
Yeah. I believe
to chime in.
Steve LaPlume. I believe
you guys make it sound like everybody's being followed around. Everybody's being persecuted. Everybody was being watched and everybody was being harassed. That wasn't true. You all know that. You both.
It wasn't true with you, Colonel, because they couldn't do that to you. They couldn't do that to you. But we were 19-year little monkey boys, airmen, nobodies, and that's an easy, probably an easy target, I guess. I mean, they couldn't mess with you. You had too much swing. You know the system. You could see it coming. We couldn't see it coming. We didn't know. We just didn't know.
Tom, I think you got some questions.
That's just my opinion.
Oh, no problem.
Sure, go right ahead.
Help yourself, girl.
Okay. Well, I have to say that your experiences were a bit extraordinary. How shall I put it? The typical person then did not have all those problems. You guys both had a lot of baggage. I'm not disputing that you had problems. I'm not disputing somebody messed with you. But nearly everybody there had led a normal life in the military. Yeah, there were problems. And you may have been followed around, but I think you're a bit paranoid.
If I may come in, this
sure.
is Peter. As
go
a professor
ahead,
of mine once said to me, you don't have to be paranoid to know that somebody is following you. Relative to Larry's claims of having his retinas burned and being exposed to a nuclear source, we have those medical records. Also, when we met in Washington, in Virginia, across from the Pentagon those years ago, one of the things that you told us was that you were curious about why Larry had claimed that there was interest on the part of the NSA in terms of his experience and not yours, and that a contact at the Pentagon had in fact confirmed that there was NSA interest in Larry, and by September of 1981, all of his service records that he did not leave the Air Force with were transferred to Fort Meade, Maryland, where they still are, even the most innocuous among them. So I don't think this is really a case of, you know, being paranoid or concerned without just cause.
Wow.
Well, I would suggest that anybody that wants to read the book, read the book. Do you know who Larry Fawcett is? Do you know who Sally Rayel is? They've done some research on a lot of the things in the book, and very interesting results.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like for them, you know, let's see what it is.
I know who Sally Rayel is, and many years ago, and Larry Fawcett, I was the initial fella I was dealing with, I think, back in 83, and he got your memo out through my information, the Holt memo, through COS. So I'm familiar with them. I don't know what – and Larry also interviewed some of the other witnesses, I know. I think we have them in the book.
All right,
and
Jim,
you know some of his transcripts.
The book said to me, and they've gone on record, is that you've been meddled with probably significantly and you cannot be believed. Now, I don't disbelieve you. However, there's some issues there.
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of issues everywhere. I mean, ask my ex-wives. But
that's all, guys. We got to take a break.
But that's all. We got to take a break. I apologize. I would love to let this go on, but we'll start right back with it right at the top of the hour. And also, folks, want to mention that you are free to call at 248-545-7685 if you'd like to call in and talk to this panel. We'd love to get your comments, questions, 248-545-7685, or use the instant feedback form at Sky Radio or Psychic Radio. This is Para X Radio and Behind the Paranormal on CBS.
And welcome back to Caps Paranormal and Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben on Psychic Radio, powered by CBS, AOL, and Yahoo. And yes, as that joiner said, the phone lines are open, 248-545-7685. You need to call and talk with the panel.
Yes, indeed, because you, well, to show you how historic this night is, to have this assemblage in a panel has never happened before, to my knowledge. Now, there have been pieces of it or greater portions of it, but not all these folks in one place. So please call. You get a chance to talk to these gentlemen. Not only the fact that they've served a great service to our country in their military service, but also they have such a tremendous amount of courage to be talking of this now. We appreciate Peter Robbins for writing of it, and Larry Warren co-authoring the book talking about the Rendlesham Forest incident. You know, it's just a great time, folks, and you may not get this opportunity again. So please call 248-545-7685. And Tom?
I have got a direct chat room question for Peter Robbins. Peter, they want to know, did the British government release any documents on the incident to the public?
Yes, they did in 2002. They released several dozen documents. And under their recent several years of declassification of several thousand documents, quite a few dozen others came up as well. I'm sorry that Nick Pope can't be included in this part of the program because he is the go-to guy on this. I've seen all the documents. I've read through them carefully. What we have is definite indications of interest where we were previously told there was none. We're concerned about security was an active question and not a passive one. And a lot of smoke, but no smoking gun. And we would not expect that any definitive documents would be released about this at this time.
Well, the only thing that I would kind of comment on with respect to that was that there are documents that show that the British government, that the MOD, wanted the United States Air Force to get involved with this, and the United States Air Force did not get involved with it. And so sometimes what you have to look at is the reverse image of what the documents show. And what the documents show basically is that something obviously occurred that was significant enough to the British MOD that they wanted the United States Air Force to handle it, because they didn't want to handle it, and that's important.
Indeed, and just let me finish Bill's thought there. In 1984, when the then fledgling news network CNN was undertaking its first special report, which was either three or four parts, and Chuck DeCaro, their technology and military reporter, shared with a number of us that Ted Turner had authorized the spending of something like $200,000, a fair amount of money at the time, to investigate this case. They put and this is CNN, a series of 20 questions to the Air Force, caught the Air Force in 16 untruths about this. Yes, the Air Force has remained very reticent to get involved in this subject.
And the important thing
Can I comment a bit on that?
Sure.
My comment is that the British government will never release the actual documents because they are not in MOD. They're in one of the M agencies, and Naval Intelligence and Air Force OSI, and you will not pry into their files.
I couldn't agree more.
That's absolutely right. And Charles, what happened to your report? Because you did write a report on this. Was there any action from the Air Force pursuant to your own statements?
A lot of ridicule. Actually, what happened was when I approached Gordon Williams and told him what happened and gave him the tape, which he played at their Third Air Force staff meeting, he said, get with Tom Moreland, who was the British liaison. We call him the British base commander, but he was a liaison officer. And I got with him. He was on holiday in Wales, and I had to wait about 10 to 12 days till he came back. And I said, what do we do, Don? And he said, well, write a memo. So I kind of cleaned things up a bit and wrote a the memo, which has since been released, and gave it to him, and he raised his eyebrows, and he sent it on to the MOD through his contact, the Third Air Force. That's why there was a copy there to be released. That's another story. It went to MOD, and he and I both sat by and by and by and by, and I kept saying, well, isn't somebody going to come investigate? Isn't somebody going to look into this? And he about pulled his hair out. And finally, we came to the conclusion after months that, well, that's it.
Mm. Now, can I work in a question here, fellas? As Paul Eno speaking, I'm trying to get back to Peter's question. Peter from Columbia, South America here, and I think you tried to answer it, but I don't think it was answered. And I'm going to repeat it. Please share the complete dialogue that occurred between the base personnel and the entities. And of course, this gets to the question we haven't addressed yet. To the best of the knowledge of any of the eyewitnesses here, was there any kind of – now, I'm former military. I know classified. Just if you can't say it, just say you can't talk about it. Was there any contact between base personnel and any sorts of life forms in this craft? Now, if we hear – let me just say John Burroughs, if we get a chance to play his – recorded a brief interview here because he can't be with us live, said that that people reported that they saw him taken into one of the craft. Again, he was messed with, et cetera, so who knows. But the question is, do any of you know, any of you witnesses know anything about any contact with aliens or other life forms who might have been in any of these craft?
I had no
idea. Here, I'm the only one that talks about that.
Okay, Larry.
Colonel Hall, yeah. Control.
I'm sorry, was what I couldn't quite catch that, sir.
What I saw was under intelligent control.
Okay.
I see. Okay. We're good. Okay, and
Larry, if you want to...
Well, I'm sorry, pal. That's been my position for all the years, yeah.
But you don't know, nobody... Yeah. How about Steve? Do you know... Did any of you participate or see any other life forms other than your own guys?
I never saw any entities whatsoever. I saw a craft, and that's all.
Okay.
Okay.
I saw the pilots.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
From an investigative point of view, this is Peter here.
Sure.
From all the parties I've spoken to, from everything I've deduced, if what Peter from Columbia is asking, if there was any conversation or discernible communication in the conventional sense, I don't think there's any authentic accounts supporting that. Communication,
okay.
Of course, a lot of it is nonverbal. In that sense, one living thing facing off with another thing implies a certain tacit communication, but this is part of the mythology and lore and myth and legend of the incident that we shook hands with them, exchanged candy bars, offered to fix their craft with Radio Shack parts. It's nonsense, and, you know, there's always a lot of that.
And I get blamed for that, and I've never said that, which is,
yeah.
Once again, the dance of doom you do with this stuff. You know, you dance with the devil. You can't win. You say one thing, it gets twisted. Researchers get pissed off because you tell the truth about them, and they spin garbage. Now, when it comes to witnesses here, if you got the young end and some of us that weren't career guys, you know, Steve LaPlume, I can say, I know he's got it all together now, and I do too. I'm a father of a great kid, and, you know, we're all hopefully good fathers. And at the end of the day, if you want perfect people, I ain't it, believe me. But, and I never will be. But
there's a very few of us.
You know, at the end of the day, I just want to know what went on.
All right, I know we got a lot of callers lined up everywhere.
Yes, we do.
What about the symbols on the craft? That's the last part of this question from Peter.
Well, you
have to look at the website.
Bennett about that, because he has a notebook that he allegedly wrote down and copied the symbols, and that's gone to print.
Okay. Well, they're also on the Behind the Paranormal website on the Talking Points page. So, okay,
yes.
So we don't know what they meant.
A lot of people have made interpretations of those symbols, but who's really the authority to make the interpretations of those symbols?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's all I had. I just.
And that's great stuff.
We have got a caller from California. Welcome,
Hello.
John, to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing wonderful.
Yes, sir. What kind of question or comment do you have? Go ahead.
My question was, are the UFO... UFO sightings, are they giving any reason to why they're coming down, or are you going to give any shedding light on why they're coming?
Well, I mean, I think there's no simple answer to that question because there have been so many UFO sightings even before 1947 at Roswell, and they've continued for, you know, in some cases hundreds of years, that you just don't know why they're making contact. I mean, if you look at 1952 over Washington, D.C., they were playing cat and mouse with us. Belgium, eight years after Bentwaters, what was that all about with the flying triangles and whose were they? So the answer is you really have to ask them.
Good morning. Hey, I'm on another phone call. Can I call you back soon? Okay, call you back soon. Bye-bye.
Absolutely.
Okay. Is he going to call back or?
I think he's going to call back later. I think we got another.
Okay. Yeah, Tim, we have Tim with us. Tim, you're
New York City.
I'm here. Am I on the air now?
You're on the air, sir.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make a comment. Now, I've been involved in the UFO investigations for over 40 years, going on 50, actually, because I had my first sighting when I was 10 years old. I consider this incident to probably be the most important event that certainly could determine somewhat more the truth about UFOs than we know currently. Also, I want to say that Larry was absolutely there that night. What he tells is absolutely true. I've known him for many years, and I first heard him tell this story long before anybody went public with it. He stood on the schoolhouse stairs with a small crowd around him in Brewster, New York, while the big flap in Hudson Valley was going on. So to say that some people say, oh, he wasn't there, he wasn't in the military, this, that, and the other thing, is utter nonsense. If anybody knows more about this case than Larry, I don't know who it is. I was going to actually ask also about the communications. But there had been some rumors that there had been some communications made, but I guess you kind of covered that. Although I did want to ask maybe Peter or Larry, if you're on the line there, isn't there now one of the witnesses, is it Burroughs, who said that he actually put his hand through the structure or went inside?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm just Paul Eno speaking. John Burroughs told me that he had done that. And I believe Mr. Peniston as well, if I'm not mistaken, they had done that. And the thing that interested me was that under hypnosis, if hypnosis is what we think it is, said that they were not aliens, they were us.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
They lie. Let's visit that when we come back. We've got to take a break. I want to talk about that. That's good because I want to go back to something that was given as a quote by Larry. I'll tell you, Larry, the breakaway is you don't get blindsided on this. Yeah. This is Para X Radio and Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno on Para X Radio Network and Sky Radio, powered by CBS. Yes, indeed. And, of course, some of our folks have phones pressed to their ears while we have these nice headphones on. So we do appreciate you folks being with us. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to these gentlemen, because all of them are very, very respected folks, in my eyes particularly, for their service to our country. Not only that, but their courage, what they have written, what they're trying to tell us about now, I really do appreciate. And, Larry, I left going to break with this question. I want to throw it out there because I had read that this was attributed to you, and it probably wasn't now that we talked about it, but I think you could speak to it, and some of the others can as well. Is the thought that the pilots and the craft itself were not extraterrestrial, but from the future?
Yeah, that would have been a little too, knowing on my part. I know nothing. I think that goes from Sergeant Peniston, you know, what he said under hypnosis, what was said to him. And personally, I would not believe the entities or the creatures or people or aliens or whatever that are behind this phenomenon, because I think they're a bit crafty, you know, like Richard Nixon, perhaps, though not quite looking like him. But the quote I would like to be remembered for that is used, I don't think I've said that. I think it's quite a good possibility. I'm wishy-washy. I don't know. I'm always looking for an answer. And you get in trouble when you do that and express your confusion. But I think at the end of the day, the quote I'd like to be thought of is, you can take me out of the story, out of this story, but it will never go away. It's too big. This one will never, ever go away. And I'd like to say one thing. That last caller you had is a gentleman named Tim Beckley, and he's an absolute legend in this stuff. And I have to say, though a UFO researcher, a very dear friend to me that even reached out one dark period in my life and even helped me, he's a dear friend, haven't seen him, love you, brother. And I'll just shut up now.
I have got a question for the Colonel. This is from John from the UK. He says, were you on the radio to Colonel Theodore Conrad while you were out in the woods after the Christmas party? He has recently reported he was on the radio to you the whole time and saw or reported none of the light phenomena.
I did not converse directly with him, but he had his radio on, as far as I know, and monitored everything that was happening. All my conversations were with the command post.
Okay. And, Dave, I think we've got a caller.
We have a very interesting caller. Tim from Texas. Tim, welcome to the show, sir.
Hi, how are you doing? Hey, this is Tim Eggersick, Peter Robbins.
Hey, you know, Tim.
You know, yes, hi. You know who I am. Larry Warren, we've never spoke, but I'm dying to meet you one of these days. And Colonel Holt, you and I have spoke also. I got a question for Larry Warren. Besides Adrian Bastienza, can you name any other D-Flight personnel that were out in Rendlesham that night?
Can I name other guys on the post? I can hear you, Tim.
Yeah.
There was, Longello. Do you remember that name?
Longello? No.
Longello. Steve is from Milpitas, California. You know, I knew a lot of the young guys. We had just all rotated over there from Texas.
Okay.
In fact, Steve was there a month before me. I do have a lot of these names. I don't even have a copy of the book right here, so let me not get myself in trouble if I say the wrong thing.
Okay.
And I do remember you from the base, too, and have a picture of you even.
Okay, great. And I just have a question, for Colonel Holt, if you don't mind. Colonel Holt, recently on one of those UFO shows, I saw you talk about beams of light coming down into the Bentwaters WSA. Do you have any – I know you say you got a witness that won't come forward, but I was working in the WSA all three of those nights, and the place would have gone nuts with a helping hand, covered wagon, broken arrow. I don't believe it happened, so I'd like you to produce a witness.
Well, I have a witness who from the 2164th Comm Squadron who was working in the tire at that time, and one of the operators who have both told me the same thing. Now, I can't say that the lights went into the WSA because I was, a mile and a half or 2 miles away. They were in that general area, but the chatter on the radio indicated they were down in that area or in the WSA. Now, why there was no helping hand?
I had command. Command of the radio. I was alternate CSC at the time, and nobody ever reported.
So you would have been over. You would have been over in the other building.
I would have been right at the entry control point of whiskey three. I was whiskey one at the mm-hmm. time, right near the entry to the WSA.
Well,
so it wasn't,
Bobby
it wasn't
Ball
the other
had the law enforcement net on, or no, he had the security net on, and Bruce England had the law, or the one had the law enforcement, one had the security net on, and I could hear the chatter in the background.
Well, yeah, there was chatter in the background that people were witnessing lights. In fact, Charlie Waters has recently come forward that he was able to see something a half mile away from the WSA, but I'm still... Since I saw the Unsolved Mystery episode, I'm still waiting for somebody to come forward to say a light came over the WSA and was shining down a beam of light into the weapons storage area. I haven't heard one person come. And not that it didn't happen, but I'm just waiting for somebody to come forward.
Well, the gentleman from the Comm Squadron, who I have his name, I don't have it in my fingertips now, who was out there both the night I was out there and on the first night when Peniston and Burroughs and Kabanasak were out there, because he was out there doing something. I don't remember what he said he was doing, but he was doing some type of work on the made-mile system or something.
Okay.
And also an object actually penetrated the air directly above the WSA.
I will back you up that somebody from the Comm Squadron did come into the WSA because I was always notified when somebody from outside the security police was entering the area. I'll back you up on that. I do remember that. I do remember he went up to the Whiskey 2 Tower, and him and Rick Bobo observed something toward Woodbridge. But I'm still up in the air on this, anything coming in and over our Bentwaters WSA. I'll let it go.
I'll defer to him, but I can tell you he has gone on record, and he was really shaken up,
and he was interviewed by the OSI afterwards.
Tim, this is Peter. I remember you referring to Rick Bobo from D-Flight, and you had actually said that he had told you that he saw what he described as a huge spaceship hovering outside the base for hours. You wrote to Georgina about that and CC'd me on the communication way back when, as I recall.
That's correct. He's also talked to Robert Hastings recently, too, and given the same account where he did notice a big, huge spaceship in the air toward Woodbridge, which would be probably directly south from our WSA area. And Charlie Waters, he said he guessed it was about a half mile away from the WSA. But, you know, I was the alarm monitor and alternate CSC, and I was alternate CSC for most of that night because of all the talk on the radio. And I think the play, we would have had a 30 and 30, if you guys remember what that was. You know, we would have recalled people from the barracks if something would have gotten near our WSA.
Well,
thanks, Tim.
I thought the same thing should have happened. However, I'm talking to the command post, and if the command post doesn't want to do anything, you think I was going to initiate it?
Okay. That answered my other question. Why was everybody out in the forest and not protecting our, you know, our number one priority resource on the base?
Well, that was my main concern. I was extremely upset at the fact that everybody was out there. There were light alls out there. There were vehicles out there. There were probably 25 people out there. It was a public relations disaster, and everything on the base was left, I won't say unprotected, but minimally protected.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Tim, thank you so much for calling, sir. We appreciate your call so very, very much.
Great talking to you.
It's Tim from Texas.
Thanks, Tim.
Great call.
And, guys, on line three, we have got Lee from New York. Welcome, Lee, to the show.
Hi. I have a question for Colonel Hall.
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay, my question is, I'm aware that you've been working on a script with Gary Hazeltine, I believe is his name, and I think one of the things that's so important in this case is to sort out fact from fiction is to get an exact chronology of who was where and when. I'm wondering, to what degree have you guys really tried to nail that down in the script and consult with all the participants and decide who was where and when and try to get a chronology to it? And then also, secondly, when can we expect to see that that movie, and in what form? Is that something that will be released on DVD, and are you guys trying to get it released in major theaters, or where and when can we expect to see that? Thank you.
Well, two questions. The first question is, I have done everything I can to provide all the data I have and everything from my files and my records to Gary to put together, and Gary's worked diligently on it and done an awful lot of research. I can't guarantee you. Now, names have been changed a little bit for very good reason, liability, et cetera, but it's going to be as accurate as possible. He did, take a little license in a few areas as far as I'm concerned, and I can't tell you when it's going to be released or how it's going to be released. That's all dependent upon who's interested.
Sure. Understood. Lee, thanks for calling, sir. We appreciate the question.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, sir. And Tom, I think you got a question for Steve LaPlume.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Steve. This is from Patsy from Ohio. She was wondering, has Steve had any contact with the agents since you've been out of the Air Force and any continued harassment?
No, absolutely not. Once I got out of the Air Force, I poked around for a year, and then I became a freelance military advisor, for lack of a better term. And I ended up in Central America, and I've had no incidents or any issues with anybody that I'm aware of.
And the fact that you live in China can't hurt.
That's true.
As Pauline knows me.
I'm in a spot right here. I don't think too many people can get to me unless they're in collusion with the Chinese government.
And I wouldn't want to cross Steve no matter what.
I wouldn't either, by the way.
We've only got 2 minutes. I've got a very quick question for Bill Burns. This is actually, I guess, a yes or no question, so we got 2 minutes left. They want to know.
Well, I want to hear Bill Burns say yes or no with nothing else. That's what I want to hear this.
No, they want to know in the chat room, this is to Bill, have there been any more sightings around the area?
Of RAF Bentwaters?
Yes.
The answer is neither a yes nor a no, because I don't know. I think that would be – that's a Nick Pope question, and the only sighting that I could point to over England that aroused that much anxiety would be RAF Cosford in 1993, but that came down the other side of the UK.
Nick Pope tells me yes.
It is, yes. It's in the papers all the time now in Suffolk. Even currently as we speak, there were major sightings happening in that region.
And also, Bill, was there not a sighting in 1956 in Brentwood?
Yes, there it was. Yes, it's RAF Woodbridge. That was
yeah,
two British.
It involved nearby bases as well, but this was seen from the ground, picked up on radar, observed by pilots in the air. Objects traveling approximately 4,000 to 6,000 miles per hour in 1956.
The British were actually, the British were actually scrambled. Two Venom fighters were scrambled to intercept it. And this particular incident made the French Commedia report on UFOs.
It's also the subject of a separate National Security Agency report on the event. It's very well corroborated. It's an area, for reasons we can only guess at, that has a significantly higher level of historic UFO activity than an area 50 miles in one direction or another.
And remember, it was in the 1950s, which was kind of a decade of the saucers, all the way from 51 straight through 57.
Indeed, indeed. And folks, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. We got the big question we're going to ask all of our panelists when we come right back. Plus, we're going to get an opportunity to have each one of them tell us about what's coming up in their lives so that you can follow them, because I know I want to. We'll be right back after this break. This is Para-X Radio and Behind the Paranormal on Para-X Radio Network and Sky Radio, powered by CBS.
Welcome back to the special edition of CAPS Paranormal and Behind the Paranormal on Psychic Radio, powered by CBS, AOL, and Yahoo. And gentlemen, I have got the question of all questions. This is from CC from San Francisco. She gave this to me about an hour ago, but I was going to hold this to the end for everybody to chime in on this. She wants to know, the bottom line, what do the gentlemen feel is the reason behind the continued cover-up? So
you
want to chime in? Go.
Yeah, whoever wants to.
Well, do you want to start just a general roundtable on it? Just go one by one down the line?
Perfect.
I would love that. Would you like to start it?
I'll start it if you like. I really think that as one person from an agency which shall go unmentioned said to me, because he once investigated a UFO-connected event in a foreign country, and the person who was involved in that summarily disappeared from the face of the earth. He once said this to me. He said that were you to figure out what the real story is behind flying saucers, what the presence means, it would so shake things, so shake the foundations of our belief system that everybody, all the powers that be, this is beyond the level of any one government, beyond the level of the chief executives of governments themselves. It's almost kind of like a worldwide group, and they're just protecting it. They're protecting it for their own ends, to make money. They're protecting it from the ends of because they don't want to see certain foundations shaken, and so that's behind it. It's kind of like the secret behind the Planet of the Apes. The apes never wanted the other apes to know what the real history was, how the apes evolved, and so they basically kept the secret, and they killed to preserve that secret. Every time that secret goes to a group of scholars, and this is going on now, they convene this group of scholars because it's been outsourced, and the group of scholars gets together and they present the issue, and even the most devout people in a screaming disclosure walk out of those briefings saying, don't ever tell anybody what the real truth is.
Interesting. Colonel Hall, what's your feelings, please, sir?
I tend to agree with that. Now, there's a lot more to it than that. There are, in this country, at least 5, maybe 7 agencies, maybe a few we don't know about, that do collect information, that do compete amongst themselves, and do provide, how shall I say, input to a certain agency. And the goal of that agency is to keep everything very, how shall I say, calm, still, keep things on keel for a lot of reasons.
There are also some issues at a more local level. Some of the local, how shall we say, commanders, OSI, NSI, you name it, have their own agendas, and they kind of keep things and filter things and squelch things to a certain extent, too. And I think there was a little bit of that at Bentwaters, but I do think it did get up channel, and I do think there were some agencies involved, and I won't mention any of them, but you all know who they are. It's interesting to know that how many presidents said they'll get to the bottom of the UFO
yes.
situation.
And they see the three ring.
Guess what? Guess what? What can I say?
Okay. Larry, how about you, sir? What do you feel?
I agree with everybody. I whoever has been holding this thing, it doesn't work because obviously, I mean, 30 years ago, you talk to people outside of this field, and, you know, I was very driven, like, let me jam this down your throat. You will feel and see the things I've seen or whatever you did back then. It was madness. And, you know, in general, you know, you get the blank, and I think Colonel Holt, Peter, Stephen, everybody has breached this subject with someone where it might be a friend, and then suddenly you have the glazed look on their eyes, and you know you lost them. So I find much less of that now. So whatever whoever they are trying to suppress, and this worldwide where people are suffering because of one way or another, it doesn't work. And now the young kids out there, I don't even know how to text, but the youngsters out there have computers, and, you know, things are pretty evident. And my personal thing is that I believe there are anomalies on Mars that cannot be explained, and the moon, and from NASA's own stuff. And I think that's where the lid's going to pop, sadly. I wish it was our thing, but I don't think it worked for them. I hope they're really frustrated that they failed.
And I've got my
asshole.
Own folks. I've got my own.
Sorry, I'm off the radio, I guess, forever.
No, you're fine. You're doing fine. I think if you take those two words and separate them, they don't match the seven words you can't. So.
Right. Forget
so if you say the first
means
one,
something
pause,
different in
that,
England.
Everything's fine. But I have my own theory about this. I think there's a big cover-up so that Bill Burns can have some material for next season. That's what I think. But anyway, Steve, let me ask you, what do you think about it? Why do you think the cover-up continues?
Well, honestly, I think it's to save us from ourselves. Look at the radio show War of the Worlds and what happened there. You know, a small area with a small audience. What would happen if everybody in the world suddenly discovered that their religious base was nothing but, you know, smoking mirrors?
Good point. Good point. Peter, how about you, sir?
Yeah, I think all of you guys have made extremely perceptive observations about this, and I can only add that when things kicked in the summer of 1947, from all of my readings as a student of 20th century American history and the works of and the actions of Harry Truman, I genuinely feel that his intention was to release information that he and the working group that he put together found. But the working group became more powerful and more institutionalized and insinuated it into the fabric of the bureaucracy. And it's still going on, and these people and their progeny are keeping their jobs. I would add also that probably one of the things we're not keen on discussing is, let's say, the present president went on television, even timing it with other world leaders, making similar announcements to their people. He would have to begin by saying that every other president, since and including Truman, whether left, right, Republican, Democrat, conservative, progressive, doesn't matter. They're all unindicted co-conspirators in keeping this secret. And part of the secret is that after 63 years, we still don't have that good an idea of what's going on and have been able to produce nothing to stand in the face of what may be a genuine reason for concern. Stock market would crash. Alcohol sales and mental institution investments would go up. There might be a panic thrown into fundamentalist thinkers, although I think overall the religious community will do well. But it is an absolute tangle of very understandable reasons why we would continue to choose to sit on this and for each succeeding administration and generation to hope that it does not blow up while they're on watch.
We have two actual documentations of the cover-up at work.
One is Walter Hout's deathbed affidavit, sworn out, I think, in 2002 and released after his death in 2005, or at least in the Tom Carey, Don Schmidt book, Witness to Roswell. In his affidavit, he actually documents Ramey's going to Roswell, meeting with the officer staff that was involved in the recovery. They all drum up the story of how they're going to cover it up. Then Roger Ramey double-crosses Jesse Marcel and basically stabs him in the back and forces him to cop to the story of the radar balloon. So that's on the one hand. And the second one is 5 years later in Washington when General Samford is going to release the story of what really buzzed the Capitol, the Pentagon, entered D.C. restricted airspace in an air war between flying saucers and the U.S. Air Force. He has a crisis of conscience, and both Donald Kehoe and Edward Ruppelt document Samford's lying to the American people, probably on instructions from Harry Truman. So, I mean, it's a fascinating kind of view of two cover-ups in motion, and they simply haven't stopped.
Okay, if I could make just one little comment here quickly. It has been suggested to me regarding the cover-up that these things continue, cover-up-wise, because people are – there was a fear initially supposedly that there's money involved, but people would freak if there were life on other planets, our religious institution was collapsed. However, all of us grew up with the Klingons on the Planet of the Apes, and today I think everyone, as it's been suggested to me, is accepting of life on other planets. However, life in quantum physics land, parallel worlds where there are things – creatures, whatever, entities, realities, right next to us all the time, who some of whom or which are hungry and hostile. That would terrify people. And that, I think, according to my information, is being used by our government, these principles, these realities are being tied into. And that's all I can say, because that's what's been suggested to me as the reason for the cover, that if it's on another planet, that's okay. But if it's right next to you, people would just lose it.
As one self-described friend of an extraterrestrial has said to me on more than one occasion, if you read Isaac Asimov's trilogy, Foundation and Empire, it's not fiction.
Wow. And with that, we've got to take a break, gentlemen. I apologize. When we come back, we're going to find out what each of these folks have in the future where you can follow them. This is Para X Radio and Behind the Paranormal on Para X Radio Network and Sky Radio, powered by CBS.
And welcome back to Caps Paranormal and Behind the Paranormal on Psychic Radio, powered by CBS, AOL, and Yahoo. Dave and Paul, this 3 hours have flown by.
They sure have.
I cannot imagine the fun that we've had. And I can't express to all those folks who are listening right now how much we've enjoyed this. And also I cannot express enough my gratitude for these folks forming this panel tonight. It's been historic. It has been informative. It has been fun, entertaining. And we also got a chance to hear Larry Warren curse on the air. You know, we,
hey, I apologize. I do.
Don't worry about that. I promise you it was great. I loved it. It was very apropos. How's that? I loved it. What we'd like to do, folks, if we can, because we want to follow you in all the things that you do. We're already talking about the possibility of a part two to this. So if that's possible to happen, we'll work on that, because we'd love to have these gentlemen come back and talk to us more. But I'd like to go down the line, if I can, and just ask if you can, very briefly, gentlemen, I apologize, there's so many here, to tell us, you know, if you've got any books out there, any events that you're going to be attending, anything like that, we'd love for you to promote that, if you would. And Colonel Hall, would you begin, please, sir?
Well, I'll be happy to. You have to understand, I have not written a book, and I have not, I've responded, I guess, to legitimate requests, to, you know, what's the story, what happened, the truth. In fact, when the initial request came in from Larry Fawcett for under the Freedom of Information Act for release of my infamous, I guess, statement I made or whatever, I didn't even know there was a copy of Third Air Force. There was no copy at Bentwaters. I had the only copy because I had it typed on a typewriter, and there was no official file copy. I got a call from 3rd Air Force, the acting commander, Pete Bent, was a personal friend of mine. He said, hey, we've got this document. We're going to have to release it. I said, hey, Pete, don't release it. Your life and mine will never be the same. I don't need this. You don't need this. Burn it. He said, I'm sorry, I'm going to release it. Well, you know the rest of the story. He released it, and I won't go into the tape, how the tape got out, but that's somewhat similar. I have not looked for publicity. I have worked with people, and I did work a bit with Gary Heseltine, and we're putting something together, or he is, and I'm helping him just to try and get the facts out there. So that's about all I have.
We appreciate that, sir. Thank you very much. And Larry, how about you?
Well, you know, I'm over here in Liverpool, and I take my boy to the wrestling, which was terrible tonight, by the way, and you know, try to be a good father. And got my act together, I think, because you need to when you're a parent, you know. I'm very proud of the work Peter Robbins and I did. It is not definitive by any stretch. And I only ventured into doing that book many years ago, and then Peter came into it because I'd been misrepresented intentionally or unintentionally in a number of books already to that point. And Whitley Strieber suggested I write a book. The rest is that history of ours, and it was only trying to help. I was only trying to, you know, stay in the corner of these guys. Hopefully, I plowed the driveway a little bit for them to come out. I hope it didn't. None of this has hurt anybody, and it's never my intention. What I'm doing nowadays, I'm not that active in this kind of thing because all the other guys are coming out, or a lot of them. If any are out there listening, please come forward and join in. Join us. I hope there's a reunion at some point and some big rich person will finance it, and we can really just kind of get this somewhere. I'm doing a little talk in Birmingham tomorrow for Dave and Katie there, and really not much else, you know, just working every day and really angry at the bankers that robbed all of us and want my money back.
I think
they're all the witnesses to this are heroes, and every one of them. And it's an honor to even be on the same airwaves with them, minus the
Thanks for staying up so late, Larry, too.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yeah, it's surreal, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an honor. It really is an honor, really, of my life. Thank you.
The honor is ours. Thank you, sir. Peter, how about you, sir?
For me, this other intelligence and whatever it is or whatever it isn't, whatever it means for us or doesn't, the best of us can only make educated guesses. For me, the focus here is the impact this subject has on human beings and in the very confined and high-tense reality of a military situation. People are put under tremendous pressure. I agree. These extraordinary witnesses that we've been privileged to share the last 3 hours with are heroic. I feel in some ways in the middle of this because I have tremendous admiration for Larry and his courage in being the initial whistleblower in coming forward and not backing down from his accounts and acknowledging the problems that he's had along the way. I have tremendous admiration for Charles Hault, whose career definitely suffered in great part because Larry was the one to go forward with this information. And I hope, as we all move forward in time, the most important thing here is the truth and keeping this dialogue open. I am crazy enough to be trying to make my living as a full-time investigative writer, speaker, consultant on this subject. If you live in New York State, I'll be giving a talk on this very case on May 6th at the Swan Library in Albion, New York. I'll be speaking on June 12th at the headquarters of the Edgar Cayce Foundation, ARE, on June 12th. I'll be in Roswell the long July 4th weekend, managing, emceeing, and speaking at their UFO conference and producing a UFO conference in Exeter, New Hampshire on September 4th, and other dates as well. Larry's in my book, Left at East Gate, is available from Amazon, and I can only encourage people to either get it or get it out of the library, read it, and come to your own decisions. But again, thank you all for including me in this extraordinary evening, and may we continue from here with
yes, indeed.
The truth before any personal aspects of this totally seminal story.
Yes, indeed. And Peter, thank you so much. We've got about a minute and a half, and I'm sure we'll want to get Bill Burns in. But, Steve, how about you? What's happening with you, sir?
Well, as you might guess, I'm a pretty private individual. I came forward on this radio show, and I talked with Linda Moulton Howe and gave her an interview. And because I believe that my sighting, while not the same sighting, it was a few weeks later, had some significance in relating to this and validating it. And having said that, I'm probably just going to fade back into the background, and I doubt I'll ever probably be on the radio again or see much more about this.
Well, we do appreciate you, sir, coming on tonight, and hopefully you'll reconsider on the next time around, because we enjoyed having your perspective about this, Steve.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Bill Burns, what's happening with you, sir?
Well, the big news is that I want to thank everybody, first of all, for a great panel discussion, and thank you for inviting me. It was terrific. We're going to – a UFO magazine is now going to be on the iPad, iPhone, Android. We're going digital on all these smartphone devices as well as the iPad. We have a radio show at futuretheater.com, which is now coming up on Saturday nights at the 6 p.m. Eastern. I've got Aliens in America, a book coming out this October about UFO hotspots in the United States and what to do when you get there. And more, and two UFO Hunters books coming out next year and the year after. They're the official guides to UFO Hunters. And we are pitching UFO Hunters as a two-hour special to a number of networks. We have some considerable interest. And I've got two motion pictures in development in Los Angeles. That's what's happening with me.
All right. Bill, thank you so much for joining us, sir. We appreciate it. And I hate to be this fast at doing this, but thank you for every person that's been here tonight. It has been a joy. Paul, thank you so much, sir, for allowing us to be a part of your show. And we appreciate you putting all this together. And you've got a shout-out we've got to do very, very quickly for somebody who put a lot of work into this.
Absolutely. Kyle Dayton.
Yes.
One of our show reporters that we all know, Kyle, and Ron Williams as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Kyle Dayton.
Great folks. Two of the best. Yeah.
Thank you all so much.
We had to get that. Thank you so much. And, Paul, thanks so much for what you've done. We appreciate it so much. Tom, it has been great. Thanks to our listeners out there. It has been fun. And part two will come. We'll try our very best to put it together. This is Dave.
And this is Tom. Good night, everyone.
From our universe to yours, this is Psychic Radio.
We know you're listening.